the hypothermia is, it was a great idea. It looks like, unfortunately, it didn't work.
Not for this subset of patients.
Or unless you're a rat.
Right, exactly.
Cool
then
down.
You're sweet.
If you
then
have head-injured rats, cool them down.
Put them in ice.
Put them in the fridge. All right, welcome to Keeping Up. This month we're doing pediatric articles. We had so many articles that we ended up having to split it. So this is going to be part one. I'm here with Sheila McMorrow.
How are you?
I am well. Thanks for coming out and recording with me. Sheila works full-time. She's board certified in pediatric emergency medicine and is one of our, probably our fastest and most efficient PEDSEM specialist down in the ED.
I do not claim that.
I do. I work with you all the time. We're working tomorrow, as a matter of fact, and it's been brutal. We'll hope for better things tomorrow. So, anyway, without further ado, we'll get started with the first article. All right. Belsha et al., Pediatric Hypertension in the Emergency Department. This was in Annals of Emergency Medicine, March 2008. Historical backdrop. This is a summary of the fourth report on the diagnosis, evaluation, and treatment of high blood pressure in children and adolescents. Defining hypertension in children is much more difficult than adults because it's a moving target. Their blood pressure changes as they age and as they grow. One helpful resource in making sure you understand what's normal and what's abnormal as far as blood pressure is on the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute website. And I've put a link on the written summary that you can find online. It's much too big to include here, and it's much, much too big to memorize, but it's an excellent reference for normal and abnormal blood pressure in pediatric patients. Now, we know how difficult it can be in the PEDSED to get an accurate blood pressure measurement. If the cuff is the wrong size, if the kid is screaming, if they're anxious, the measurement can be way off. I just don't know if this happens to you, but I get two-month-olds with 136 over 90 all the time. Crazy.
Yes.
So it's tough to get a good accurate measurement. Now, a little definition of terms. Stage 1 hypertension is a blood pressure that's less than 5 millimeters of mercury over the 99th percentile for age, gender, and height. Stage 2 is greater than that. That is greater than 5 millimeters of mercury over the 99th percentile cutoff. Board relevance. Extremely important to us as ED docs is not only recognizing hypertension, but recognizing hypotension. Again, it's a moving target, but a quick way is to use a formula. What we use is hypotension is defined as a systolic blood pressure equal to 70 plus 2 times the age. So let's just do an example. If we have a 2-year-old, that would be 70 plus 2 times 2 would be 74. So a systolic pressure of 74 or less would be equal to hypotension in a 2-year-old. Now, of course, this is in PALS, your standard formula, and it does break down in kids less than a year, and it breaks down in kids greater than 10 years of age. You know, you can't have like a 90-year-old, so 70 plus 2 times 90, I mean, you don't get to be 250 is hypotension. So it breaks down with certain ages. So the results of this article, this is really a summary of this fourth report on the diagnosis, etc. So we'll just give the bullet points. It's recommended that all children 3 years and up have a blood pressure measurement with each medical encounter. Use the right size cuff, try to calm the child down, and use normative blood pressure tables to determine whether the blood pressure is normal for age, sex, and height. Hypertension is defined as a systolic or diastolic pressure greater than the 95th percentile for the age, sex, or height on 3 separate occasions. This is a very formal definition. Let me hit that one more time. It's defined as a systolic or diastolic blood pressure greater than the 95th percentile for their age, sex, or height on 3 separate occasions. Also, this summary article recommends that children with symptomatic stage 1 hypertension and all children with stage 2 hypertension need immediate workup, including usually an EKG, basic metabolic panel, CBC, looking for evidence of hemolytic anemia, HUS, etc., and a urine analysis looking for an active sediment. If they have neurological symptoms, a head CT is indicated. These children that have stage 2 hypertension or symptomatic stage 1, it's recommended in this article that they have immediate 25% reduction in blood pressure with IV drugs, labetalol, nitroprusside, or nicardipine would all be recommended drugs in this population. So the application to your clinical practice, the next PZD shift, or the next time you're seeing a child with a whacked out blood pressure, I just would say keep in mind that it's out there. Hypertension is there in the pediatric population. Many of these kids with severe hypertension are going to have a secondary cause that if you treat, you can save their life. And up to a quarter of these kids will have retinopathy, convulsions, or encephalopathy on presentation. So hypertension in children is nothing to be trifled with. It's a serious illness, but it's often hard to spot. And I blow these things off all the time and probably shouldn't. But it's just we get so many false positives. What are your thoughts, Sheila?
No, I think one of the key points to this is that it should be on three separate occasions. And that's definitely something that the pediatrician needs to follow on as an outpatient in different time periods. However, there are more organic causes for hypertension in kids than essential hypertension in adults. I would say that the majority of disease processes that we think of with kids that have true hypertension and sustained hypertension is renal disease, either post-strep or drug-induced or something related to the kidneys. And coarc is a very uncommon cause of hypertension in older children. However, it has been picked up that way. So that's always something to remember as well.
That's a good point, and I forgot to mention that. They do recommend getting blood pressure in the lower extremities. Normally, the pressure in your lower extremities is a little bit over that in your uppers, and so if it's 10 millimeters mercury systolic less than your uppers, could be an indication of an unrecognized coarc. That's a great point. You know, three separate occasions is a good point, and probably the application is we just need to put that on their discharge.
Yeah.
Your pressure was a bit high. You need to get a recheck.
Exactly.
And I could be better about that for sure.
All right, our next article is by Bonsu et al. It's a decision rule for predicting bacterial meningitis in children with cerebral spinal fluid pleocytosis when the Gram stain is negative or unavailable. This is from Academic Emergency Medicine in May of 2008. The historical backdrop: this article sought to come up with a decision rule to distinguish between bacterial and viral meningitis when the Gram stain is taken out of the picture. A lot of this, the reason for this article stemmed from the fact that at smaller community hospitals, Gram stains may not be available during the entire day, and the decision of how aggressive to be on antibiotic administration is sometimes questioned. But keep in mind that quite a few children come in with a scenario of being pre-treated, so the Gram stain at times is inconclusive anyway, so they sought to look at other lab values that would help. So for board relevance, bacterial meningitis is a devastating disease at any age. And aseptic meningitis can mimic bacterial meningitis in signs and symptoms and can be very challenging to differentiate on lab values. So remember, if the child looks sick, then assume the worst and give antibiotics. The results of the study came up with a decision rule that listed six lab values. The first one was that the CSF white count was greater than 600. The CSF leukocyte percentage was 74% or higher. The CSF glucose was less than 40. The CSF protein was greater than 100, the peripheral white count was greater than 17,000, and the peripheral band and neutrophil count was greater than 10%. So in this decision rule, when they looked at all of these patients that had meningitis in Columbus and in Boston, they included all the patients that had a positive CSF culture for bacterial pathogens, as well as those who had positive enteroviral PCRs. What they did is each of these six things they assigned a number to, so you got a point if you had any of those lab values. And they found that any patient with a score of 0 or 1 did not have bacterial meningitis. So if you had a score of 2 or greater, you were at much higher risk, which goes along with a lot of the CSF studies that if you have a high white count, if you have a neutrophil predominance, if your sugar's low and your protein's high, that all goes along with bacterial meningitis. But they found that it was very sensitive and that kids who did not have 2 or more of these episodes, none of them had bacterial meningitis. So the application to practice is that although the Gram stain is extremely helpful if it's positive, at times it can be falsely negative, even in cases of bacterial meningitis. So this article kind of takes the Gram stain out of the picture and lets you look at other lab values. I think the common or the biggest take home is that no matter what, if the kid looks sick, then give him all the antibiotics that you can.
Just treat him. Yeah, exactly. You know, in this article, we usually have the luxury of a Gram stain, but generally if a child's febrile and has meningeal symptoms and I'm worried about him, especially if they're altered, I may go ahead and give antibiotics, plus minus scan, and then LP. But certainly there are kids that are not that sick, and you say, oh my gosh, the CSF is positive, mm-hmm. and here's where this study really comes in handy. You know, they derived this, then they internally validated it. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, they did a practical number. They sort of rounded. They came up with a 597 CSF white right. count. So they rounded and made the numbers easier for us to remember.
Yeah.
But it's a helpful decision rule, and it's one of those things where it has a high sensitivity, negative predictive value, negative likelihood ratio. So it's going to be one of those things that's helpful for ruling out. The specificity wasn't bad either,
yeah.
but it's predominantly designed to say, who can we not give antibiotics to?
Exactly. And especially in those kids that come in that have had headache and neck pain and fever even for 2 or 3 days that you don't think would have bacterial meningitis because
exactly.
you would think they would be sicker. But those are the kids that it would might be useful in.
I have to say, though, if a kid had over 500 white cells in their CSF, I think
we're
I would just treat them in a
yeah, exactly, no matter what.
I'm a decision rule wimp.
Yeah.
All right, speaking of spinal fluid, the next article's by Mangaludiso et al., Corticosteroids and Mortality in Children with Bacterial Meningitis. This was in JAMA, May 2008. Corticosteroids are useful in preventing the complication of deafness in children with Haemophilus influenza type B meningitis, although some studies would recently challenge that. In general, that's been a truism from prior study. But since the advent of the Hib vaccine and the heptavalent pneumococcal vaccine in children, the landscape of meningitis has dramatically changed from what it was in the early 80s. In adults, the administration of dexamethasone right at the time of antibiotic administration or just prior has been shown to reduce mortality, at least in developed countries. Now, some recent New England Journal articles have shown that in countries that have lesser resources, probably is not that beneficial. But in developed countries, the U.S. and some European studies have shown that in adults, it probably is a good thing. It definitely is a good thing. The board relevance, after this article, I really think that you should give steroids in adults with meningitis unless you suspect tuberculous meningitis, and you should not give steroids in children with meningitis. It doesn't appear to help. The results of this article, let's get on to it. This was a retrospective study utilizing the Pediatric Health Information System database. Patients less than 18 years of age from 2001 to 2006 were included if they had a diagnosis of bacterial meningitis. Now, of course, they excluded kids that had CSF shunts, VP shunts, VA shunts. The main outcome measures were death and time to discharge. So these are pretty hard outcomes. And patient-centered, I might
yeah.
say. So it's kind of hard to fake death. They found 2,780 diagnoses of bacterial meningitis during the study period. Streptococcus pneumoniae was the most common organism. Of this almost 2,800 patients, 248 of them, or 8.9%, received corticosteroids. 15 deaths occurred in the children who received corticosteroids. That was in 6%. In the group who did not receive corticosteroids, there were 102 deaths. But, although the number was greater, that was only 4% of that population. The relative risk was 1.5, but the confidence intervals crossed 1. Also, the time to discharge was a median 10 days in the non-steroid receiving group and 12 days in those who received steroids. Even when the results were adjusted for potential confounders using, get this, propensity-adjusted Cox proportional hazard regression models, which I do those every shift, every day.
Every patient.
Anyway, there were still, when they eliminated confounders with some sort of weird biostatistical mathematical thing, whatever, on a computer, there were still no differences in the main outcomes. There was also no difference when results were stratified by age of the child or by organism. So no matter what your age, no matter what the bacterium, the steroids were a wash. They really did not benefit in mortality or time to discharge. Application to practice is this. It looks like in the era of the Hib vaccine and the heptavalent pneumococcal vaccine, adjuvant steroids are not indicated in pediatric cases of meningitis. Now, the caveat is, what if they weren't vaccinated? So,
well, and that's, I think, the bridge that we're crossing now, because there are so many parents who are choosing to not vaccinate their children. And we're seeing more cases of Hib. Probably than in the past 10 or 15 years, just because of this choice. So I think now we're needing to rethink all these things, and I'm sure that we will probably see a rise of both of these diseases as children remain unimmunized.
I hope we don't, but I mean, it's clear. Yeah. There's an MMWR article that just came out, some HIV cases breaking through in Minnesota.
Yeah.
So it's out there. Still keep it in mind. But as a general rule, no steroids in kids with meningitis.
And I think even in kids before Prevnar, I think steroids given to kids with pneumococcal meningitis, it was not found to benefit.
Yeah.
So really the only benefit that's been found is with kids with HIB, and it's particularly for deafness. But at this point, yeah, the recommendation would be to not give steroids for meningitis. So moving on to something that we all know and love in the PDD, bronchiolitis. This is Corneli et al., a multi-center randomized controlled trial of dexamethasone for bronchiolitis. This is from the New England Journal of Medicine in July of 2007. So I think that bronchiolitis is the bane of every ED physician's winter.
Amen. I am so tired. another winter. Great.
Because you feel so helpless and you feel so bad for these poor kids and their parents that have dealt with all this wheezing and congestion and the fact there's no medicines to help.
Not a darn thing you can do.
So bronchiolitis is the most common lower respiratory tract infection in infants and can lead to frequent hospitalization in this age group. There have been multiple medical therapies that have been tried to see if anything can help these kids. Bronchodilators have been used, racemic epi therapies have been used. They've all had very inconsistent benefits and no consistent improvements. Steroids have been used to treat bronchiolitis, but the evidence of their effectiveness is very limited. So this study sought to assess if a one-time dose of oral dexamethasone changed any hospital admission rates. For board relevance, bronchiolitis is highest for preemies, for kids less than 12 months, and during the winter months. RSV is the biggest player, but there are certainly other viral causes of bronchiolitis that we just don't test for yet.
Yeah, it definitely puts them at higher risk. The younger they are, if they've had prior apnea of prematurity, mm-hmm. witnessed apnea at home, apnea in the ED, there's some good studies that have come out recently about who's at risk for apnea. So you really need to know who's going to die if you send them home.
Exactly. Which that's your biggest thing when you see a child in the ER with bronchiolitis is what is their dispo going to be?
Yeah.
So this study, they took 600 children between 2 and 12 months, and they randomized them to receive either 1 milligram per kilo of dexamethasone or placebo. And they were observed in the emergency department for 4 hours after that. So they included kids that had to be their first episode of wheezing. It couldn't be a kid that had come in on multiple occasions with wheezing episodes. And it had to be within the first 7 days of symptoms. They used a respiratory distress assessment instrument and had different scores for respiratory rate, what the quality of their wheezing was, if they were tachypneic, if they had retractions, what their PO status was. And they classified kids as if they had a score of 6 or greater, they were included. So these are the kids that are in moderate distress because of bronchiolitis. They excluded children who were premature, who had congenital heart disease, who had immunosuppression for whatever reason, if they had been on steroids within the past 2 weeks, or included active varicella, which I thought was a funny inclusion. Not sure exactly.
A whole lot of those coming. I mean, you still see it, I guess. But.
Yeah. It was just interesting. It kind of signaled that out. But what it showed was that the admission rates for kids who received dexamethasone was 40%, and the admission rate for kids who received placebo was 41%. So their admission rate and their length of hospital stay was no different. And even children with a history of HIP, if they had eczema, if there was a family history of asthma, there was no difference in response to steroids. So even the kids that you think might have some reactivity in their airways by either a family history or some kind of atopic picture, this did not change their admission criteria or their length of stay in the hospital. So your biggest thing with application of practice is that in children with bronchiolitis, steroids do not work. Do not give them to them. They do not improve their symptoms. And besides suctioning and supportive care, there's really no therapies for bronchiolitis.
Have a nice day. Stinks.
See you tomorrow in the ER with your wheezing.
Hate it for you. A recent article by Walsh et al. In Academic Emergency Medicine in April of 2008 compared nebulized epi to albuterol and bronchiolitis, you know, speaking of medical therapies that don't work, really the bottom line of this study is they did show by the skin of their teeth that albuterol was slightly superior to nebulized epinephrine in the treatment of bronchiolitis, but really it was a relative risk or an adjusted relative risk of 1.18 in favor of albuterol over epi in getting kids discharged from the ED. Mm-hmm. And the confidence intervals did not cross one, but barely.
Yes.
So,
very close.
You know, some prior studies have shown that nebulized epi was no better than placebo. That was a New England Journal article in 2003. This shows that nebulized albuterol just barely edged out nebulized epinephrine. But still, it's not the bomb. I mean, it's not all that. So
the kids that are able to be discharged from the hospital, I think even if you do try albuterol or epi, those are kids that probably would be able to go home regardless.
Either way. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it does seem anecdotally. Yeah. These kids are wheezing to beat the band. You give them a quick racemic epi, and they do seem to transiently improve. But then they get all junked up again and caked with mucus, and you're suctioning them out. So what we really need is some clinical predictors of who can be safely discharged.
Yeah.
Hence, the next article. Okay, next up. Mansbach et al. Prospective multicenter study of bronchiolitis, predicting safe discharges from the emergency department. This was in Pediatrics, April of 2008. Historical backdrop. When you're dealing with bronchiolitis in the PZD, you should ask yourself, should they stay or should they go? It's like the old song. That is, who needs to be admitted and who can be safely discharged? Children with hypoxia, markedly increased worker breathing and respiratory rate, inability to take liquids, those at high risk for apnea, that would be newborns, former preemies, prior apnea of prematurity, witnessed apnea at home or in the ED, earlier in the illness, a lot of other things. Those kids should be admitted. Not a lot of pediatricians, when you call, are going to give you much pushback when you say, they're hypoxic, or I'm really worried about this kid. Well, they'll push back on the I'm really worried about this kid, because then they'll listen to him after you've really worked on him and suctioned him out all night, and they'll be like, this ER doc's an idiot. But anyway, that's okay. But the question is really, who's safe to send home with bronchiolitis? So that's what the study sought to answer. Before we move on to the results, the board relevance, you really need to know who should be admitted. And some hard signs would be the things that we just mentioned. Hypoxia, they can't take PO, worker breathing issues. The younger they are, the easier they are to have apnea. And so I'm much more lenient about admission, less than 2 months for sure. Mm-hmm. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I agree. I think, and, you know, I think if we admitted every kid that was RSV positive, we would never see the light of day. But I think there are definitely some kids that, and usually those are sometimes the ones that come to your medical attention that, for whatever reason, they have a little bit more severe course. And you're right, like you say, the timing of the illness is also, if they've been congested for a week, they're probably going to be fine.
Yeah.
But day kind of 2, 3, 4, 5 is hard.
Yeah. And they can definitely get sicker. So this article, as they looked at all these children, they prospectively enrolled kids in 30 different emergency departments around the country during the bronchiolitis seasons of 2004 to 2006. Children less than 2 months were excluded, and greater than 2 years were excluded. So it's that age range. And using logistic regression, a number of clinical variables were derived as predictors of safe discharge, and they were subsequently internally validated within the same study. The primary outcome was repeat ED or clinic visit within 2 weeks of ED discharge. This follow-up was obtained by telephone. 1,456 patients were ultimately enrolled, of which 837 of these were discharged home. And of these, 722, that is 86%, were followed up within 2 weeks. So this is a little, I think, problem. There are 14% that didn't follow up, and we don't know what happened to them. We'll talk about that in a minute. Of this 722 that were discharged home and followed up, 49 were subsequently readmitted to the hospital. 55% of these were within the first 24 hours. So in plain English, 837 kids went home, 722 followed up. Of the 722, 49 readmitted to the hospital, and over half of them within the first 24 hours had to come back. On multivariate analysis, What they did was they found predictors of safe discharge. They derived these, they internally validated them. And this is what they came up with. You're safe to discharge kids, as a general rule, age greater than 2 months, if they have no history of intubation, if they have a history of eczema, which is a little counterintuitive, if they have age-specific respiratory rates that are in the normal range, generally less than 40-ish. Mm-hmm. They really stratify this out by age, 0 to 1.9 months, and then the next age range, and then the next age range, but generally less than 40 or 45. If they have no or very mild retractions, and if their initial oxygen saturation was 94% or greater, and they also found that fewer albuterol or epinephrine treatments given in the first hour tended to predict safe discharge, and if the children could have adequate oral intake. They applied their model to the 1,012 patients that had a complete data set. And what they found was if they had applied this model, 21 or 2% of kids would have been classified as low risk, but subsequently readmitted within 24 hours. And all of these kids were non-ICU kids. So the rule actually would have worked pretty well had they applied it in this setting. Application to practice, I think there are some follow-up issues that are not clearly addressed in the paper. The 14% that were not followed up, what happened to these kids? Well, the authors don't comment. Did you see that? And I missed that?
No. It just, they didn't include them.
There's no comment. They could have dropped off the face of the planet. I don't know what happened to them. The results make sense intuitively. Over 2 months, never intubated. You know, they're not tachypneic. They're not retracting. Their SATs are greater than 94. They're not getting many treatments. They're taking PO. I mean, these are kind of the things that we would say, which makes sense, except for the eczema piece. I'm not sure about that. There are a couple of subjective things as part of this rule. Fewer NEBs is not defined. Fewer than
what?
100?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Pick a but number.
Fewer NEBs, if you say they're receiving fewer NEBs. So whatever you say. And oral intake is a subjective assessment as well. It just requires physician judgment. I would suggest using this model with caution until it's externally validated. But it's a good place to start when you're rationally considering who's safe for discharge. Mm-hmm. The follow-up issues need to be addressed, and external validation needs to be done. But these criteria make sense to me, mm-hmm. and I think it's a good place to start. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that it is a good framework to start with. However, I can't tell you how many patients I've seen between 6 and 12 months that are maybe around 9 or 10 months that are happy wheezers, happy. The respiratory rate's in the 60s. You can hear them wheezing from outside the room, but they're playing and they're eating. And so these, if you took the respiratory rates from this article, these children would definitely not qualify and would probably need to be admitted on that just with these values. But those are kids that almost never have to be admitted. But that's something to caution with. So I don't think they're in cement, but it's a good guideline, I think, to keep in mind.
Yeah, if I admitted every kid with a respiratory rate greater than 40, I mean, forget it. I'm lucky if I see a bronchiolitic with a respiratory rate that's less than 40. I mean, I've discharged lots of kids who breathing in the 60s that look like a million bucks.
Wonderful, yeah.
So, but it's a good place to start. Exactly. And you're definitely safe if you...
if you admitted everyone with a respiratory rate of more than 40.
It sure won't
capture
happen.
Everyone. So our next article is near and dear to pediatrics, particularly in the last year or two.
Oh, yeah.
This is Sharfstein et al. And this is over-the-counter but no longer under the radar pediatric cough and cold medications. This was from the New England Journal in October of 2007. So this historical backdrop, this article brings to light the very common usage of over-the-counter cold preparations in kids. And in the past 8 years, so since 2000, there have been 750,000 calls to poison centers over concerns for these medications that are readily available in most households. There have also been 123 deaths related specifically to over-the-counter cold medications in kids under 6 over the past 20 years.
Yeah.
So the relevance for boards is that over-the-counter cough and cold medicines can have very different effects than the same medication given to an adult. Again, kids are not just little adults. So this study,
come up with that?
I've heard that somewhere before. So the results of this article kind of compile that there have been six very good studies since 1985 in kids under 12 that have all shown that there's no difference between these over-the-counter cough and cold medications and placebo. Basically, they don't work. So the FDA and the American Academy of Pediatrics released a statement last year stating that kids under 2 are not to be given over-the-counter cough and cold medications. They actually are lobbying for kids under 12 to not be given this. However, they have not. I think the fact that they've gotten kids under 2 has kind of been a major breakthrough.
Yeah.
Particularly because there's so much marketing to little kids and to parents to give them these over-the-counter cold medications. These are dangerous medications for kids because they can cause cardiac arrhythmias, they can cause hallucinations, they can cause depressed levels of consciousness. You know, giving a kid Benadryl just to make them sleepy, it's not really the right thing to do.
I know.
So, and the dosing of these over-the-counter cold medications is completely sporadic. What the drug companies did was that for kids between 6 and 11 years old, they just said, take half the adult dose. And for kids between 2 and 5, they said, take a quarter of the adult dose. But these were just random and kind of picked out of nowhere. And that's why it says for kids under 2, consult your physician. So the drug companies are not very happy with the restrictions of cough and cold medications for kids under 2. Now, I do think it's the responsibility of pediatricians and us as emergency medicine physicians to continue to educate parents that these are not medications that their children need to be taking. They are only the cause for increased risk of ingestion. There are so many different preparations that have 5 different ingredients in them, from anticholinergic effects to antihistamines to sympathomimetics. I mean, you just see the range of symptoms and manifestations. So for application to practice, these drugs have not been shown to provide any difference than placebo in kids less than 12. So don't give them to them. And particularly don't give them to them in kids less than 2. You will definitely see overdoses of these medications come to the emergency department as little kids get into these medicines that taste good. And you'll be, I'm continuously boggled at how many preparations are out there and how many different ingredients are in each medication.
One thing to remember is the recent articles that have come out advocating the use of buckwheat honey. Hey, it's a great cough suppressant.
Yeah.
And it tastes great too.
Yeah. I mean, it's just bombarding.
These parents want something to do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if their child has some fever, just give them Motrin.
Yeah. Keep it simple.
Yeah.
You know, and even for the older kids, sometimes if they, kids that are 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, or even teenagers, you know, stick to one thing, like stick to Sudafed.
Right.
Or just one ingredient medication. You know, when you mix up all these different things, you're not getting, and a lot of times parents don't know that there's actually Tylenol in their Pedicare, and they're giving them Tylenol, they're giving them Pedicare, they're giving them Robitussin, all these different things, and pretty soon you're getting multiple doses of the same medication that parents don't realize that they're giving.
It's a big problem. I mean, I had a little girl just the other day that overdosed on a Dayquil type preparation, mm-hmm. and it had acetaminophen in it, and so we're drawing Tylenol levels. So this stuff is out there. You're going to see it. The FDA has helped us here, mm-hmm. and I think that they've given us ammunition to sit down and have honest conversations with families and say, we've been telling you this for years. Mm-hmm. Now the FDA is telling you this. This is not right. This is not the best thing for your child.
Clay and I work with another pediatric emergency medicine doctor who tells parents that it is illegal for their child under 2 to have these medicines, which I think sometimes parents, that's how you have to be blunt with them and just say that it is illegal to give your kids this medicine now.
It ain't right.
That's right.
Next up, an article by Hom et al. Is fluid therapy associated with cerebral edema in children with diabetic ketoacidosis? Annals of Emergency Medicine, July 2008. No. Next article. So, this article backdrop. There's debate about giving normal saline boluses and aggressive IV fluid administration to pediatric patients with DKA because concern that aggressive IV fluids in this population is a risk factor for developing cerebral edema. Cerebral edema from DKA is an extremely rare but often lethal complication. It occurs in about 1% of patients but it's associated with 57 to 87% of the deaths related to DKA. It's rare, but lethal. This is an Annals critically appraised topic article that searched the literature for the best available evidence regarding IV fluid administration in DKA and its association with cerebral edema. Board relevance: use caution in giving insulin to new onset type 1 diabetic patients. They are very sensitive to insulin, and you will drop their glucose very quickly, and usually too quickly. I would recommend, and we see this all the time because we get transfer patients in, I would recommend starting fluids first and then just seeing what fluids do to their glucose before starting an insulin drip. We do still tend to not bolus insulin initially, and in a new onset diabetic, we generally recommend outlying facilities don't immediately start a drip. Mm-hmm. Is that what you recommend as well, Sheila?
Yeah, because you're right. They're so sensitive to fluid changes, and just by even by rehydration, you can likely correct most of their acidosis on just with fluids.
You definitely get them heading the right way, especially if they're a milder DKA case. Now, there is little controversy that in hemodynamically unstable patients, isotonic saline boluses are indicated. Also know the common general precipitators of DKA. They all start with I: infection, infarction, infant, indiscretion, and insulin lack. Now notice, these are not all applicable to peds, although in your teenage patients that have a uterus that works, definitely be thinking about that one. Infant, get a pregnancy test. Results of the article. The authors searched Medline and Embase and found three case control studies that addressed the study question. Now, given the rare nature of the disease, observational studies provided the best available evidence that's out there. You can't really do a randomized control trial on an outcome that's so rare. Two studies measured the amount of fluid in milliliter per kilogram per hour, and one measured the total volume of fluid administered in the first 4 hours, irrespective of weight. One study showed the total volume of IV fluid, if it was greater, correlated with increased risk of cerebral edema in the first 3 to 4 hours. But this was the study that didn't give the volume per kilogram. The other two studies, which did provide information on milliliter per kilogram per unit of time per hour, found no association between IV fluid administration and milliliter per kilogram per hour of IV fluid given prior to the development of cerebral edema. Interestingly, in these three studies, 12, 5, and 19% of patients had cerebral edema on presentation prior to receiving any IV fluid administration. Mm-hmm. So how does this apply to your practice? Well, the best available evidence suggests that aggressive rehydration with IV fluid is not associated with increasing the risk of cerebral edema. So I would say, feel free to tank them up. Just don't go overboard. You don't want to pound these kids with fluid. So if they're very unstable, definitely bolus them. If they're really dry, go ahead and give them some aggressive fluids. This is not going to put them in cerebral edema. Likely what gives kids cerebral edema is the underlying severity of the illness and acidosis when they hit the door.
And you know, this is cerebral edema is not an adult disease. This is strictly seen in pediatrics, and no one really knows why. The only Nate Kepperman has done a lot of his research with DKA and cerebral edema, and really the only factor that has been shown to increase rates of cerebral edema is if the BUN is elevated upon presentation. But giving bicarb has not been shown, but has not been encouraged, has not been proven to help. He has done a lot of studies looking at these kids that come in, even who don't have altered mental status, but they are doing, in California, they're doing these SPECT studies, PET scans, that show that they're, most of these kids that come in with some level of DKA already have evidence of cerebral edema, whether they're clinically manifesting or not. But I think the biggest thing is we don't know why kids do this. And the thought is that kids are much more sensitive to osmolar changes, and that if you flood them with a bunch of fluids, or if you flood them with insulin and you drop their glucose too quickly, that this causes too many shifts, especially in these little children, you know, less than 10, that are much more sensitive. So for sure, if their hemodynamic status is in question, be aggressive on the front end. But certainly in new onset diabetics, I would be very hesitant to give insulin boluses to these children. Our next article is by Hutchison et al., Hypothermia Therapy After Traumatic Brain Injury in Children. This is from the New England Journal of Medicine in June of 2008. So the backdrop for this is that hypothermia therapy improves survival and outcome in animal models, particularly in rats. So the question is there any effect, does it have similar effect in children? So there was a small study in 1997 that found that 24 hours of hypothermia decreased the risk of poor outcome, which they defined as death or permanent disability after a certain amount of time. So the problem with this study, however, was that it didn't have significant power or enough patients to actually detect some differences. So this study sought to assign children with severe traumatic brain injury to either the hypothermia therapy or normothermia. So they got enough patients to have power to see if this initial study was true, and they actually expected for the hypothermia patients to do better. What the hypothermia meant was that these children were cooled to 32.5 degrees Celsius for 24 hours. This had to be initiated within 8 hours of injury. And then the normothermic group was at 37 degrees Celsius. And then they evaluated these children 6 months after the injury, and if they were severely disabled, if they were in a persistent vegetative state, or if they had died, those were the outcomes that they looked at.
Yeah.
So for board relevance, traumatic brain injury is definitely a hot topic, and it is unfortunately a fairly common clinical presentation. Studies in adults have not shown that hypothermia is beneficial in traumatic brain injury. There is some data in neonates and in adults with hypoxic ischemic injuries that may be beneficial, but not with traumatic brain injury.
Yeah, and post-arrest is an emerging field that's, I think, real.
Yeah.
I mean, we do all kinds of stuff that has very little evidence in ACLS and PALS, and hypothermia actually has some good randomized controlled trials. So, but this is a different thing. Trauma and arrest is, they're two different
mechanisms for sure. So the results of the study, they had 225 patients that were randomized in three different countries and at 17 different centers. They were ages 1 to 17 years. They either had to have a GCS of 8 or less. They had to have a positive CT scan for some kind of intracranial injury. And they had the need for mechanical ventilation. So these were your very sick trauma patients. The patients that were excluded were kids that were seen after 8 hours of injury. If it was non-accidental trauma, so all these little kids that were shaken babies were not included. If they had had prolonged cardiac arrest at the scene, if they had a high C-spine injury, if they had an isolated epidural, these were not included. If they had penetrating trauma, or if they had developmental delay before the injury. So there were actually quite a few exclusions, but they really tried to hone in on kids that had acute, blunt, traumatic brain injury. So at 6 months, the hypothermic group had 31% with an unfavorable outcome, which is this severe disability, persistent vegetative state, and 23 of those kids who were in the hypothermic group had died, which is 21%. Versus the normothermic group at 6 months had 22% that had an unfavorable outcome. So about a 10% less of unfavorable outcome. And they had 14 deaths, which was 14% versus the 21%, which is at hypothermic, which is their p-values were very impressive for this. So the hypothermic group also had more hypotension and more vasoactive agents that were needed when they were being rewarmed after the initial 24 hours of being cool. So in terms of practical administration or application, children with traumatic brain injury do not seem to have improved outcomes with hypothermic therapy. It does not improve outcome, and it may actually increase mortality. However, there's still a huge variability in treatment for children with traumatic brain injury. Hypertonic saline is really coming out in the literature as an adjunctive therapy. Hyperventilation is still always hotly debated.
Yeah.
And I think the outcome of this severe disability and persistent vegetative state has so many factors that it's not due to one variable. The article also commented on how, you know, they kind of took a 24-hour period of cooling as what their goal was. And who knows, should it be less than that? Should it be more than that? They did think that, you know, maybe even cooling them before 8 hours would be something that would be helpful. But the logistics of getting someone cool with before that time period was going to be very technically challenging. So they found, however, for these parameters, for 24 hours, keeping them cool did not seem to improve outcome.
It reminds us that there are several things that we can do in traumatic brain injury as ED docs to improve outcomes that are low-tech and easy. For example, preventing hyperthermia, mm-hmm. we know that's bad. We know elevation of the head of the bed, that decreases ICP, and that's easy. Mm-hmm. So as soon as you clear that spine, get their head up as soon as possible. Giving adequate sedation for painful procedures, pre-treatment when you're doing rapid sequence intubation. There are a lot of things that we can do that are really low tech that can improve outcome. Aggressive treatment or prevention of seizures, things like this, preventing hypoxia, preventing hypotension. You know, these are all basic good brain care. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's where we need to focus a lot of our attention right now. The hypothermia is, it was a great idea. It looks like, unfortunately, it didn't work.
Not for this subset of patients.
Or unless you're a rat.
Right. Then, right. Exactly.
Cool
then
down.
You're sweet.
If you have head injured rats, cool them down.
Put them in ice.
Put them in the fridge. All right. Next, Mace et al. Clinical policy. This is an ACEP clinical policy statement. Critical issues in the sedation of pediatric patients in the emergency department in Annals of Emergency Medicine, April of 2008. A lot of articles in April of 2008. Mm-hmm. Historical backdrop. Procedural sedation and analgesia, or PSA, is a staple part of ED life. It is essential if you're going to be a PDM physician. You cannot reduce fractures, close a lot of lacerations. There's so many painful things that we do. Oh, bronchiolitis being... Anyway, never mind. But yeah, we got to sedate kids all the time, especially in the summer. Wow. There's a lot of debate over several hot-button sedation issues, and this clinical policy attempts to use the best available evidence to form this statement on these issues and questions. The evidence is graded, as in all of these policy statements, as level A, B, or C. Level A data, for example, is generally really high-quality class 1 data. For example, a randomized controlled trial with no bias and with no downgrading would be a class 1. That's a level A recommendation. Board relevance. The incidence of aspiration in emergency pediatric surgery patients undergoing general anesthesia is as high as 1 in 373 patients. Now, that's pretty high. Keep in mind, though, procedural sedation and analgesia in the PZD is very different. We're not giving general anesthetic, and we're not instrumenting their hypopharynx. We're not intubating. So aspiration risk in the pediatric population is much less, and we're going to get to that. The results. This is a hot topic. Is pre-procedural fasting necessary? Mm-hmm. There is no level A data, but some level B evidence suggests that NPO status prior to sedation is not necessary. In pooling of 8 ED-based pediatric sedation studies, there were 2 episodes of aspiration in 4,814 patient encounters. And both of the cases of aspiration were in patients that had been kept NPO,
yeah,
which is pretty funny. There is a lot written in this summary statement. There's an evidentiary table that has article after article after article. This is the bottom line. NPO status really does not affect whether you can sedate or not sedate. I think as a general principle, if they have food in their mouth when you're pushing the drugs, you should take that out.
Other than that, anything goes.
You do have to follow your hospital's protocol, so I don't want to get you in trouble here. I don't want to get me in trouble here.
No, but you cannot apply the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Their NPO guidelines are 8 hours. That is for elective procedures that are non-emergent, and their NPO, anesthesiology always kind of cringes when we say, you know, they've NPO for 3 hours, but for us, it's a completely different arena.
Like, NPO 3 hours? Cool. Let's go.
Ready.
So now, next question, is nitrous oxide safe and effective? Level A evidence says yes at a 50% concentration. Level B evidence says use a gas scavenging system. You don't want laughing gas floating around in your department or your dental office or wherever you're sedating these kids. And it does say that there's some question of whether it can cause some neuropsychiatric problems in your staff that are constantly exposed to laughing gas. Well, shocker.
I'm not surprised.
Use a gas scavenging system, whatever that is, a little gas scavenger. Level C data suggests that the 60 to 70% concentration of nitrous oxide is also safe and effective. It also says, level C data, use caution when you're mixing this inhaled anesthetic and also other IV anesthetics because it certainly has
Compounding.
Yeah, compounding effect. An increased risk of respiratory depression and hypoxia when you mix agents. It also suggests that it's less effective in younger children, less than 2, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it suggests level C data, trained nurses can administer it. Keep in mind, nitrous oxide can be emetogenic,
mm-hmm.
so it can make kids sick.
You know, the University of Minnesota is a big proponent of nitrous oxide, and it's actually nurse-driven, but they use it for all their VCUGs, for a lot of their IV sticks. So they use it actually throughout the hospital in different departments, but they do have a pretty well-set-up scavenger system that they have one room that's dedicated for nitrous use, and they use it judiciously.
I would like to use this. Mm-hmm. I mean, no IV access, that would be wonderful for some of these mildly painful procedures. Just gas them.
Yeah. We had an EMS rig bring in a kid on nitrous.
Oh, really?
Yeah. From Wilco. Yeah.
If they can do that.
I know. I think we can too.
Yeah. Let's gas them. Now, this is an important caveat.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, it says nitrous oxide on the tank. Every nitrous oxide tank is mixed with oxygen to some degree. This is just like any gas. It can be an asphyxiant. If you have 100% nitrous oxide, that means
no oxygen.
There's no oxygen. So, you know, that's an important caveat. And most of the deaths from nitrous oxide are from people that don't know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't use this drug because I haven't been trained in it,
mm-hmm.
but I'd like to be.
Mm-hmm.
Can oral sucrose be used in infants for mildly painful procedures? Well, anecdotally, I would say whenever I'm down in the dumps in the PZD, I just run to the cafeteria and I'm grabbing some chocolate or coffee or something. So
that's all you need.
Yeah. Endogenous opioids are good. And some level A evidence says, yes, in neonates, oral sucrose is good and does decrease mildly painful procedures, decreases pain. Level B data says that the most common dose used is 2 milliliters of 24% sucrose. Where they got 24%, I don't know. That's just table sugar. Also, level B data says it's safe in term infants, and using it with a pacifier increases its efficacy. Had a kid, anecdotally speaking, the other day that was getting a hip spica, and we gave him a little ketamine, and he was starting to wear off, and it was long after that I knew that ketamine was gone. We popped his pacifier in, and the kid slept through the rest of the procedure. It was wonderful.
That's awesome.
Pacifiers are good. Level C data says it's effective in children. It's less effective, in children 1 to 6 months of age, but that 75% sucrose may be better in this population. It also recommends level C, that it should be given 2 minutes pre-procedure. It's not an immediate effect. There's level C data that suggests that it's safe in preterm infants. So, yeah, I think it's
sugar high for everyone.
Bring it. We do it. I mean, one of our attendings always works the night shift, and she always brings in loads of chocolate, and now we know why.
That's exactly.
It relieves the pain, especially in the wintertime. We need pain relief.
That's so true.
Next question, is chloral hydrate safe? Level A evidence says it is effective for non-painful procedures, but it has a risk of respiratory depression. Also, level A data suggests that it's less effective in children greater than 48 months. Some level C data, it has potential for resedation and prolonged effects. Some studies say up to 24 hours. Chloral hydrate can be weird.
Mm-hmm.
They can not sleep through the procedure, then get home and crash, and you can't wake them up. So not super crazy about it. But some level C data says it is safe to be used in patients that have congenital heart disease, but it's less effective and has more adverse effects in children that have neurodevelopmental problems.
Mm-hmm.
Often you have to use a 70 to 100 mg per kg dose, max of 2 grams, and repeat doses are very frequently needed to provide adequate sedation. I don't use chloral hydrate. Do you use it?
There's so many other agents out there that are superior. They have a safer profile. Chloral hydrate, you know, these are the kids that, you're right, they might get some sedation for procedure, and then they go home in their car seat and obstruct their airway because this chloral hydrate's sticking around for multiple hours, yeah. So this chloral hydrate's probably okay for kids that are admitted, that are going to be monitored for 24 hours after administration. But for kids that are going to go home after the emergency department, there are so many other options that are safer that I don't think it's worth the risk.
What are you using most of all for a non-painful procedure, like a quick head CT?
Pentobarb.
Phenobarb. Mm-hmm. You give it oral IV, medication. Orally?
Oral. You know, kids less than 18 months respond great to oral Phenobarb. It's right around 18 months to 2 years that it starts to have a paradoxical effect.
Yeah.
But if you give them oral Phenobarb, even for, you know, at 4 milligrams per kilo, you give it to them, you wait 15 minutes, you turn the lights off, have mom rock the kid. The kid's asleep for 30 minutes and it's all you need. I even give it to kids that are going to get contrast because it's enough of a gradual sedative that they don't crash as quickly as they do with IV Phenobarb and they're not out for as long as IV Phenobarb.
Yeah.
So I've, for the younger kids, especially the non-painful painful procedures, I use Phenobarb. Versed is so variable.
Yeah.
And especially with kids that you need a contrasted CT on or right. something like that, it's you have one chance to get pictures and Versed is just, it doesn't do enough for most kids.
You know, I found with propofol, often I'm using these super high doses too. I start like peeing in my pants and having a very tight sphincter or a very not so tight sphincter. Anyway, I find that I'm starting to give 2 mg/kg, then 3, then 4. Yeah. And I'm like, oh,
yeah.
That's a lot.
No, I think propofol, especially in kids, when they're, I think propofol for sure has a completely different effect on kids than it does on adults.
Yeah.
You know, it would be commonplace to use 50 milligrams of propofol in an adult.
Yeah.
Or 100. In kids, there are some, you know, 4-year-olds that I induce with 50 milligrams of ketamine. They need 2 per kilo.
And you mean and propofol?
Mm-hmm, I mean, sorry, of propofol. Yeah. That they just need that elevated bump to get their receptors saturated, and they really don't reach steady state until they're loaded.
And they seem to really metabolize it quickly,
yes,
too.
Yes, yeah.
I'll tell you what drug I love. I love ketamine.
Yeah.
I'm a ketamine guy, and it's so safe, mm-hmm. and it's so predictable. Mm-hmm. If I give 1.5 to 2 mg/kg of IV ketamine, they're out. Mm-hmm. See you later. Mm-hmm. And I know for how long they're going to be down. Mm-hmm. I just love it. It's so smooth and safe.
I've had 2 adverse outcomes with ketamine. One was a little girl that had received an opioid fairly, maybe 15 minutes before we gave ketamine. And I don't know if it was the combination of the two, but she obstructed very quickly and desatted, but responded to bagging and did fine the rest of the procedure. And the second one was I had a really bad case of laryngospasm with ketamine. And it was a tongue lack that... we were done with, and he spasmed kind of at the end. But anyway.
Did you give him succinylcholine and bag him through it?
Mm-hmm.
Scary.
Yeah.
So just goes to show you, you better be on your airway game if you're going to be sedating kids. Next, what clinical indicators support safe discharge after procedural sedation and analgesia? Mm-hmm. There is no evidence available.
There's none for procedural sedation. There's the things that we probably tend to use are the guidelines that the American Society of Anesthesiology uses, which is they can tolerate PO, they can hold, they have truncal support, they can hold their head up, or they can walk with assistance, and they're not vomiting. So those are kind of the big things. But you're right, there's no evidence for procedural sedation.
Yeah, common sense stuff. Stable vital signs, good SATs, walking around, talking, eating popsicles, send them home.
That's right.
Application to your practice, whatever you use for procedural sedation and analgesia, you better know the drug well. And if you're not an expert in airway management, you better not be using a drug at all. Mm-hmm. And for every sedation, you need to set up the room, and I recommend the mnemonic SOAP. Suction, which is yank hour suction. Oxygen for the O, which is a bag valve mask, ability to deliver oxygen to the kid. A in the SOAP mnemonic, airway equipment. Have it out, have it ready, have an appropriate size tube stylet, laryngoscope, everything ready, and some adjuncts. And then P, pharmacy. Mm-hmm. Have some drugs readily available in case you have to move to intubation in these kids. SOAP.
I think you always have to anticipate that you're going to have a kid deeper than you think you're going to. And you just have to be able to manage that. So if you're going to put someone deep, you need to anticipate that they could become apneic and could lose all of their airway reflexes, even when you don't intend them to do that. Because everyone responds differently to these drugs. If they have combination of drugs, it definitely compounds the effects. So just be wary and be sure that you have good bag valve mask skills.
Yeah, be able to bag a kid or tube a kid. And finally, follow your hospital's protocols regarding fasting. Our PDD has certain protocols, and we sort of loosely follow those. But you should know the true evidence, and I think that we should be advocating for shorter times of NPO.
So our next article is by Montini, from the British Medical Journal in July of 2007. It's called Antibiotic Treatment for Pyelonephritis in Children, a Multicenter Randomized Controlled Non-Inferiority Trial.
There you go.
So nothing's inferior in this trial. I love the Brits. So yes,
they're so smart.
They talk really cool, too. The backdrop of this article is to compare the efficacy of oral antibiotic treatments alone, or treatments that start with IV antibiotics and then the kids go home with oral antibiotics in the setting of acute pyelonephritis. So the primary outcome of the study was to see if there was any renal scarring at 12 months, because that's the biggest thing you worry about with pyelo, are there any long-term effects from it? And we know that vesicoureteral reflux can cause renal scarring. So pyelo can definitely account for hospital admissions, but if kids can tolerate oral antibiotics and fluids, they could potentially be sent home. So previous guidelines and practice have recommended initial parenteral therapy, usually 48 hours of this, followed by oral antibiotics. However, in the recent, this is probably 3 or 4 years ago, there was a study with cefixime, which is generic for Suprax, that showed that Suprax alone in kids over 2 months was sufficient to treat pyelo as an outpatient. So even these kids that you think, this is a 10-week-old with pyelo and fever, and they can be sent home on Suprax? And the answer is yes.
I'm glad Suprax is back.
Yeah. The oral liquid formulation was out of commission for a while, but it is definitely back and forth. So for board relevance, UTIs among febrile infants between 2 and 24 months is around 5%. Even in kids less than 2 months, the majority of bacterial infections that are found in these febrile neonates that we do septic workups on is primarily their urinary tract. So pyelo in kids that have no history of renal disease who look good should be considered candidates for oral antibiotic treatment. So what they did with this trial, it was actually done in Italy. There were 500 kids between 4 weeks and 7 years of age with clinical pyelo. Had a fever, had evidence of white cells and pyuria on their urine, and had a good story for it. So what they did was they divided them into either oral Augmentin in 3 doses, TID for 10 days, or they gave them Mercefin once a day for 3 days and sent them home on Augmentin for 7 days. They hospitalized actually all of these kids to ensure that they, to note a difference and to ensure that they actually took the medications. So there was no difference in renal scarring between kids that had purely the oral course versus the kids that got parenteral therapy from the get-go. There was no difference between when the fever defervesced or at 72 hours they checked urine sterility, and for both groups they were both sterile at that time. So the key point is pyelo, even in little kids, can be treated with oral antibiotics and not necessarily IV. Now if these kids, some of them come in very febrile, very vomiting, very dehydrated, they have a bump in their BUN and creatinine, those are kids that you likely will admit for hydration purposes. But the kids that are tolerating PO, these are definitely candidates that you can send home on oral antibiotics.
It makes me nervous to send home a kid from 4 to 6 weeks that's febrile that has a UTI on oral antibiotics. I'm not sure I can go there yet. Mm-hmm. Although the data would suggest that that's perfectly safe in this age range because they stratified it out for various ages. A lot of pediatricians will balk at this too, so you need to work this out with the local pediatrician that's going to be caring for the child. But it does suggest that it's going to be safe.
And I think something, like you say, and what we always have to think about in pediatrics is what the compliance is going to be.
Yeah.
Because there's some families that just, for whatever reason, might not give the kid his antibiotics. And so those, especially the younger kids that are febrile, if you admitting them and making sure that they actually get their initial doses, sometimes is more of a social reason, because we clearly know that it works if they get their medication as an outpatient. But sometimes that's definitely a factor. Our last article is another disease process that we see in the PZD that's very near and dear to all of our hearts, gastroenteritis. This is an article by Rosalind from the Annals of Emergency Medicine from July of 2008. It's the role of oral on Dansetron in children with vomiting as a result of acute gastritis or gastroenteritis who have failed oral rehydration therapy. And this is a randomized controlled trial. I thought this was a great study because it's something that we see so often come to the emergency department, and it's something that's so easy to do and give. So as a backdrop, our oral rehydration is safe and effective, and it's the recommended therapy for acute gastroenteritis with dehydration. So even before Zofran or ondansetron was available, the other antiemetics that were available, such as Reglan and Phenergan, had so many other side effects. Kids were either too sleepy to drink that they never rehydrated themselves, even though they weren't vomiting. And Reglan also had some extrapyramidal effects. So with the advent of ondansetron to the kind of the playing field, it was initially used just in oncology patients, but it has an excellent safety profile. It's very well tolerated. It doesn't have these other side effects of somnolence that other antiemetics have, but most of the studies that have been done on it focus on its IV use. So this study focused on the oral use. So for board relevance, rehydration therapy is oral. Try and give oral rehydration. IV rehydration if oral is unsuccessful.
You know, there's a important to mention, the FDA has issued a black box warning on promethazine in children less than 24 months. Mm-hmm. So that's something important to know just for your patient care. It's too sedating, and there are actually some deaths from excess sedation and respiratory depression from promethazine use, Phenergan use in kids less than two. So,
and it's a very widespread thing, I think.
Yeah, I steer clear of that drug.
Yeah, and now that ondansetron is generic, it's much more easy on the wallet when you get to the when the patients get to the pharmacy. So.
Oh yeah.
So in this study, there were 106 patients between 12 months and 10 years old who came in with vomiting and had mild to moderate dehydration based on their clinical exam. They had failed oral rehydration. Basically, they had tried to orally rehydrate them in the ER and they had vomited. So the patients who weren't included in this were those patients who had received an antiemetic in the 6 hours before coming to the emergency department, if they had an underlying chronic disease, if they were in shock, if they had severe dehydration, which is greater than 10% body weight, or if they had a known allergy to ondansetron. So half of these kids received oral ondansetron at 0.15 milligrams per kilo, and the other half received placebo. After they received the medication or placebo, then the PO challenge was reattempted 30 minutes later. So 11 of the 51, which is 22%, who received Zofran required IV fluids. But 30 of the 55 who received placebo, which is 55%, required IV fluids. So 22% versus 55% needing IV fluids is a really big difference.
That's
so
huge. That's huge. A lot of IVs.
It's a ton of IVs.
That's a lot of dispo.
Yeah, exactly. Nursing time, you know, child pain, all that kind of stuff. So of the kids that also received Zofran, only 6% of those were admitted versus 13%, which is double of those who received placebo. So the other thing to note in this article was that they used the oral dissolving tabs for Zofran or for ondansetron. Ondansetron also comes in a liquid form, but they think that there's actually some associated diarrhea that's that comes with the liquid form because there's sorbitol in it. So that's why they took that kind of out of the picture and used just the oral dissolving tab. But oral ondansetron is a great option for kids who present with gastroenteritis, and it comes in a liquid and oral dissolving form. It's been shown kids who have cancer have been using it in 6 months and above. And even there are some cases that they use it in less than 6 months. But usually 6 months is kind of the age range that you want to start thinking about being able to use this. And give kids with vomiting a chance with this oral medication before putting an IV in.
I've changed my practice on the basis of these recent ondansetron articles. I'm much more apt to give them oral Zofran or oral ondansetron and then wait 30 minutes to give them a PO challenge. And it's remarkable. I've had some really sick-looking kids that I thought, no way is this going to work.
And they turn around.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the panacea. Some kids still go on to get IV fluids and get admitted, but at least give them a try. Mm-hmm. It's 30% better
than nothing.
Placebo. Yeah. So.
And if you can get it in them and they don't throw it up, it lasts for 8 to 12 hours. Yeah. So you actually have quite a bit of time then to buy before it wears off. So.
Exactly. Personally, anecdotally, it's a good thing. The last gastroenteritis that I picked up from the PGD, Tofran was my friend. The ODTs.
Good for all.
Well, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this month's episode of Pediatrics Articles Part 1. Make sure you come back next month. We're going to be covering Pediatrics Articles Part 2. And thanks so much for Sheila for recording with us. I hope you've enjoyed this month's episode. Please go to our website and make sure you check out all that it has to offer. Blogs, all the written summaries, and more. So check it out. And now for a little legal and CME mumbo jumbo that we have to take care of. Keeping Up is copyright Vanderbilt University, 2008-2009, all rights reserved. Please don't make copies or change the content in any way, but please do tell your friends about this because that's the way we're going to spread the word. Don't forget to get your CME credit. You can get that by going to our website, www.keepingupinem.com, and follow the links. Vanderbilt University School of Medicine is accredited by the Accreditation Council for CME to provide continuing medical education for physicians. Vanderbilt University School of Medicine designates this educational activity for a maximum of 2 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. Physicians should only claim credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. Thanks so much for listening to Keeping Up. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we hope you'll listen again and tell your friends. Thanks. Bye.